This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
In the untouched regions of the forest, the kōkako runs through the treetops feeding on leaves, flowers and fruit. The South Island kōkako, with its distinctive orange wattles at the base of the bill, hasn't been sighted in many years and may be extinct. A situation the blue-wattled bird of the North Island may find itself in unless its habitat is preserved. Its delightful call includes a variety of rich organ and bell-like notes.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community, or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Hello, friends. Today we have the good fortune to have Professor Robert Patman from the University of Otago with us. And he is a keen academic in the field of international relations, and he speaks out publicly about issues that matter to New Zealand. And he got the recent Critic and Conscience of Society Award given by universities in New Zealand's Gamma Foundation. And you can podcast this by going to oar.org.nz, then going to Community or Chaos and Podcast. Robert, could you talk about New Zealand joining AUKUS and give us a description of AUKUS and the pros and cons of New Zealand joining AUKUS? I think that should probably be our main topic tonight. Day.
First, the rationale was to bolster what was called the international rules-based order in the Indo-Pacific. Now, while no specific threat was spelt out initially, it's quite clear that the three participants, the US, UK, and Australia, saw China as China's rising influence within the Indo-Pacific as a threat to that order. And AUKUS actually consists of two components. There's Pillar 1 or Part 1, which involves the transfer of nuclear-powered submarines to Australia over three decades, and Pillar 2, which involves cooperation in the area of cutting-edge defence technology. New Zealand received an invitation in March 2023 to consider joining Pillar 2. And since then, the previous government and now this government have been actively exploring the prospect of New Zealand joining Pillar 2. So to sum up, AUKUS, the fundamental rationale of AUKUS is to deter China and counterbalance its influence in the Indo-Pacific. And at the time we're speaking, New Zealand is still actively considering joining Pillar 2, although the government says it has not made up its mind and has made no commitment yet.
So this would be quite an advance on Five Eyes, wouldn't it?
Well, it depends what you mean by advance.
I mean, we'd be more committed than we presently.
Five Eyes is not directed against any one state. It's simply it's an information.
That's a difference, isn't it? Because this is directed against China.
Yes, even it is. Both pillars are directed against China. I mean, a lot of people keep distinguishing between Pillar 1 and Pillar 2, but, you know, as Clausewitz pointed out, strategy is about the relationship, effectively harnessing the means to the ends. Pillar one and pillar two are both part of the means to an end. We know what the end is. It's to counter Chinese influence.
Yes. Well, China's influence may need countering, but also we don't want to surround them in such a way that they feel quite threatened, do we?
Well, I think there's another issue here, Marvin, quite apart from the one you just mentioned. AUKUS is based on the assumption, shaky assumption in my view, that China is the sole or major threat to the international rules-based order. Now, let's be quite clear for our listeners and viewers. New Zealand is critically dependent on an international order which is based on principles and rules rather than power. We trade with more than 100 countries. So let's be quite clear. We need that order in a way that great powers don't. So having established that, it's not clear that China's the only threat.
Well, Gaza would be a threat too, wouldn't it? The rules-based order.
US great power exceptionalism is a threat. And actually, you could argue that the rationale for AUKUS lies buried in the ruins of Gaza. Because if AUKUS has been established to protect the rules-based order from China, it's failed to do so in Gaza, which then raises the question, is it really about protecting the rules-based order, or is it about protecting US dominance in the Indo-Pacific from what is seen as a China threat? But let me just move on to the other threat so our listeners realize that there are multiple threats to the rules-based order. One we've mentioned, US power, great power exceptionalism, that the US doesn't always walk the talk when it comes to adhering to the rules-based order, which it says it upholds. Secondly, we've got Russian expansionism in Ukraine, which is a huge threat to the rules-based order, an illegal annexation of a democratic country, and Mr. Putin shows no signs of giving up. What are the other threats? Well, the other threats come from problems which don't recognize borders, such as climate change, transnational terrorism, global pandemics. None of these problems recognize borders and cannot be fixed by military balancing. So that's
doesn't the,
cannot be fixed by unilateral great power moves. No, these problems are too big for superpowers to fix. They can only be fixed by self-interested international cooperation. So when you think about it, the claim for AUKUS is that China's the major threat. The counter argument essentially is, sorry, there are multiple threats to the international rules-based order, and China is just one of many.
What did you think about, this is a bit out of the blue, but it turned out that New Zealand intelligence may have been used by probably the United States for military purposes a couple of years ago.
Yeah, well, we've also had a report in the last 24 hours, which is not too dissimilar to that, that New Zealand was included as one of the countries involved in protecting the national security of the United States, listed as a close ally in a U.S. document, although it's not clear that the U.S. New Zealand government knew about it. So
where does our independent foreign policy go?
Well, the incident you referred to certainly is 18 months ago or 2 years ago.
Yes.
That's a big question. The question for New Zealand is, will AUKUS help us preserve an independent or distinctive foreign policy? I prefer distinctive because I think all countries claim to have an independent foreign policy. We certainly have a distinctive. What's a distinctive foreign policy mean for New Zealand? It means that we share a lot with Australia, the US, and the UK, but we do not follow identical policies. New Zealand's approach has been one of unity rather than uniformity.
Yes, well, that's one of the things that brings some people to New Zealand. It brought me to New Zealand.
It's been a great diplomatic asset because Pacific Island states, which, by the way, are not particularly keen on AUKUS, and ASEAN countries, which also are not particularly keen on AUKUS, they always make a distinction between New Zealand and, say, Australia. Australia is seen as much closer to the United States, whereas New Zealand, with its non-nuclear security policy and also its willingness on occasion not to support a US initiative which is not seen in New Zealand's interest. For example, 2003, the US illegally invaded Iraq, and Helen Clark, the then Prime Minister, said, no, we won't support that because, first of all, it's a breach of the rules-based order, but secondly, it's not in our strategic interest or that of the United States, actually. But and her, I think Helen Clark's strategic judgment of saying no was vindicated by events. So I think most people in the Indo-Pacific believe it's wise for New Zealand to protect its own interests through pursuing a distinctive foreign policy.
Don't the island states, aren't they better off if they can trust us?
Well,
and aren't
the
we better off?
Thing to bear, yes, it is. And trust means if we're seen as capable of exercising some independence ourselves, we're more likely to be trustworthy rather than being seen as a lackey of a great power. And the other thing to note here is that neither the ASEAN, the 10 ASEAN states, or the Pacific Island states see themselves as pawns in the strategic game between the US or China. They're quite happy, by the way, to plug into the rivalry to extract more resources from both parties,
sure,
which is understandable. New Zealand's not above doing that itself. But at the same time, they jealously guard their sovereignty. What is the national security? What is the number one national security concern for most Pacific Island states? Well, it's undoubtedly climate change, because if that's not fixed or it's not addressed, rising sea levels actually physically imperil their physical existence. So you can see why they are determined to do something that will protect their national security interests, but do not want to get drawn into what they see as a strategic sideshow, which is US-China rivalry.
Isn't this a good reason for remaining leaders or trying to be leaders in climate change?
Sorry?
Isn't an active leadership in climate change something that the South Pacific expects of us?
Yeah, it's not only just expected of us, but it's in our core interest. We're an agricultural exporter. And no one would suffer more from a progressively more unsettled climate than New Zealand. It would actually undermine the economic backbone of the country. So, you know, the farming community, they were many sectors in the farming community were devastated by extreme weather in the North Island last year. This pattern may well increase unless international community shows much more willingness to tackle this long-term problem. And New Zealand has a part to play in sensitizing the international community to the need to address this problem.
We can only do that if we're a good example.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we've run out of time. I mean, the idea that we've got, you know, another decade or something to get on top of this problem, most scientists believe that we could reach a tipping point by 2031. So we're running out of time rapidly, and we're beginning to see the manifestations of extreme weather globally.
Could you comment about our relationship with China and the foreign minister visiting New Zealand recently?
Wang Yi.
Yes.
Yeah, the visit went very smoothly, actually, and I think it was a frank exchange. My sense of the meeting was that it was yet another warning by the Chinese leadership, which have grown in intensity, to the Chris Luxon-led government not to join Pillar 2, because through Chinese eyes, Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 are linked. They both serve the objective of deterring China. Sorry.
And part of deterring China from American perspective may be to make sure that hopefully that China doesn't become a major competitor with them. It already is, or doesn't increase their.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. I agree with that. I think what happened at the meeting between Wang Yi and Mr. Peters was, first of all, Mr. Peters noted that China's growing role in the Indo-Pacific wasn't a figment, as he put it, of his imagination. And China seemed reluctant to acknowledge that. So there are real concerns about Chinese assertiveness, particularly in a part of the world where we have close links, the Pacific Island states. On the other hand, while Mr. Peters stressed that New Zealand's decision on AUKUS would not be shaped by Chinese pressure, he also indicated it would not be shaped by external pressure elsewhere, which I think was a reference to the United States won't force us to join Pillar 2. He said the decision will be made purely on the merits of what's in New Zealand's interest. So in a sense, I think the reason that the meeting went well is because China came away from the meeting believing, they described Mr. Peters as an old friend, and I think they were convinced that New Zealand is not committed to AUKUS but is weighing up the options. And China's sufficiently shrewd to know that this may be New Zealand's way of, how should I put it, not dismissing the American offer and going through the performance or appearance of carefully considering it before reaching a no decision. That is to say, if New Zealand, after a year or 2 years of exploring the option, says, no, I don't think this is going to work for us, then America can't say, ah, but you didn't carefully consider it, and they would not feel slighted by the outcome. So that may be the option. I don't know. But it's quite clear that China is deeply concerned about this, and there have been warnings since that meeting by the Chinese leadership. In fact, the Chinese ambassador to New Zealand has made it quite clear that New Zealand, of course, has the right as a sovereign country to make its own choice, but there will be consequences for New Zealand. And, of course, those consequences will affect the farming sector of this country. China is our biggest trade partner. They've done something which the United States has not been prepared to do. They gave us a free trade agreement. And that's delivered a lot for our farming community. So the government has to weigh this up very carefully.
If New Zealand doesn't join AUKUS, I should say, and our relationship with China remains similar to what it is,
yeah,
is there any way we can influence China's own foreign policy? Because they have decisions to make.
I don't think, first of all, joining AUKUS will not necessarily influence China. It could play into the hands of the
If we don't join AUKUS.
Sorry?
I'm saying if we don't join AUKUS,
yeah,
will we be in a position to be listened to by China?
I think New Zealand has to address what's been a long-running problem, which has been underinvestment in the defense sector. If you want to be taken seriously, you have to walk the talk. And New Zealand has underspent in defense. It would also help us bolster our relationship with Australia. So Australia would be delighted. By the way, there's pushback in Australia against AUKUS. AUKUS will not survive Mr. Trump becoming president. And it may not. And as I said before, the rationale, AUKUS has been dealt a body blow by the events in Gaza, where you've had a bonfire of international law, which is supposed to be the rationale why we need AUKUS to protect us from the Chinese threat against international law.
Well, let's have some music and then we'll come back.
Sure.
We're talking with Robert Patman on New Zealand foreign policy and our distinctive foreign policy. And we've been discussing AUKUS and China and other aspects of New Zealand's foreign policy and the world of order and disorder. You can podcast us by going to oar.org and then going to podcast and then going to Community or Chaos. Well, Robert, thanks for coming back again.
No worries.
Robert, one of the difficulties with world order from a diplomatic perspective, and it's been there for a long, long time, and that's spheres of influence. I'm sensitive to it because I'm sympathetic to both to Cuba and to Latin America generally.
Mm.
And I guess that you would not want to see the Chinese Sea becoming a sphere of influence in the way the Caribbean is. But it's a difficult one for America to promote, in a sense, because the Caribbean is still considered, to some extent, an American sphere of influence. Well, it seems to me that the big nations are still demanding that, kind of. Not right, but they're demanding a special influence over their neighbors.
Yes, but they're doing it selectively, of course. For example, the United States quite rightly opposes the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which, of course, is illegal under international law. But the United States in the past, of course, has intervened in its own neighborhood. Now, to be fair, most of the US interventions occurred during the Cold War, when there was a fear of communist penetration of what was seen as the American, the American sphere of influence. Since the Cold War, as far as I know, the United States hasn't actively intervened to overthrow governments there. But you're quite right. I personally believe that China, the US, and Russia, they may have the motivation to dominate their respective regions, but I think objectively that's becoming more difficult in an interconnected world where countries believe their sovereignty is just as important as anyone else's. And that's going to be an uphill battle for, I think, the superpowers. You know, one thing that we should note is that in the 21st century, many of the problems confronting all countries, whether they be superpowers, middle powers, or small powers, increasing number of those problems don't recognize borders. And you might say to me, well, hasn't that always been the case? No, it hasn't. And so as the 21st century unfolds, we're seeing the autonomy of great powers. We're seeing their autonomy, their ability to act unilaterally diminish, not because they're weaker, but because simply the problems are so big, they can't be fixed by a great power acting alone.
That's certainly true of climate change, and it's probably true of international war. I mean,
yeah, before transnational terrorism,
before World War One, Europe was in the state of one side triggering a war.
Yeah,
or the possibility, well, and in some ways, with international missiles, any major power can trigger a war. So it really behooves all powers to cooperate in reducing that likelihood.
Yes, and I think this is one of the great challenges. One of the big challenges for the great powers in the 21st century is to come to terms with their diminishing ability to rearrange the world in their own image. This affects their ability to intervene regionally. Of course, they can do that. Countries can use their considerable power, but they will pay an increasingly big price for doing that. And it seems to me that kicking and screaming, some of the key problems we face will have to be solved by self-interested international cooperation. And you may say, oh, well, that's wishy-washy idealism, self-interested international cooperation. However, let's look at it the other way. What's the alternative to internationally agreeing to fix problems? It's not tackling them. And if we are prepared not to tackle transnational terrorism, if we're not prepared to tackle problems of the expanded global economy, if we're prepared not to tackle climate change, then we need to say so up front. So, you know, as Edmund Burke once said, politics is all about the choice, is all about tough choices, the choice between the intolerable and the disagreeable. And I think gradually great powers will have to come to terms with the fact that although they're more powerful than previous eras of great powers, they have less opportunity to use that power because we live in an increasingly interconnected world in which other countries, middle powers and small powers, do not see themselves as an extension of the US, China, or Russia. So this is a reality that the great powers have to come to terms with in the 21st century. And it comes directly back to your question about wanting to dominate the region. Look at China. It's made a 90% claim to the South China Sea region and alienated virtually all of its neighbors in the process.
When we're talking about world order, it seems to me one of the dangers to world order comes from individual nations and the growing mistrust of people with their own governments and their own institutions.
And I think that's symptomatic of a deeper problem, Marvin, which we've just been talking about, which is the key institution which was set up in the aftermath of the Second World War, the UN, and particularly the UN Security Council, has become dysfunctional and powerless. And this is causing enormous international disquiet. The veto power of five countries is actually destabilizing global security in the 21st century. That was not the case when the veto power was first given. Why did countries like New Zealand reluctantly accept the veto power of just five countries in 1945? They did so in the pragmatic belief that having the great powers inside the UN would help the UN solve world problems that it faced. That assumption has unraveled in the 21st century because now we have countries like the United States, China, and Russia. They use the veto to block anything they don't like, but they are incapable of putting a solution in the place of the problem or of the resolution they are blocking. So we fall between two stools. We now can block five countries can block international solutions, but they cannot unilaterally impose their own replacements as an alternative. And so we have a whole host of problems now which don't get any attention. And so this is leading to enormous disquiet. Gaza is a great example of how the UN Security Council has been paralyzed on this occasion by the use of the veto by the United States in the face of huge majorities in the General Assembly, which wanted to basically have a ceasefire from late October onwards. So this is what leads to frustration. It also leads to a gap between young people who believe this is immoral, doing nothing when great people are suffering, or not great number of people are suffering, and governments which are used to complying with great powers. One of the reasons New Zealand hasn't been more vocal and many other countries haven't been more vocal is because it's not because of a lack of sympathy. It's because they do not want to alienate the United States, the Biden administration in the United States. But that in turn has led to a gap or disconnect between many governments and their own populations.
I agree with you about that, but I think that's just one of the gaps. I think the other gap is the ideal of international rules-based order was identified by many people with the Washington Consensus and free trade and neoliberalism. Now, I'm not sure that free trade and neoliberalism are one and the same. I think they are not one and the same.
No, I disagree with what you just said. I think the U.S. has always conflated a U.S. rules-based order with an international rules-based order. New Zealand has always had a different worldview from the United States. New Zealand actually wants to get rid of the veto. So it wants to strengthen the international rules-based order. And that's why, coming back to AUKUS, New Zealand should be wary of joining an arrangement in which two of the three members have a get-out-of-jail card when it comes to complying with rules, because they can veto anything they don't like. New Zealand doesn't have that option. So I would be very careful there. I think the majority of countries do want a truly international rules-based order. They don't want a U.S. rules-based order.
I agree that we need an international rules-based order based on the United Nations, hopefully.
Sure.
But I think that I'm looking at the Rust Belt states that voted for Trump, voted for Obama twice.
Yeah.
And so I think it's foolish to think that the people who vote for Trump or vote for right-wing politicians do this mostly based on racism. I think it's based on mistrust of the governments that haven't done much for them.
Yes, in the case of the United States, a recent poll showed that 77% of all Americans had little faith in their political system. Unfortunately, American politics is extraordinarily penetrated by big money, which mean that lobbies often frame policies which are widely unpopular. We know two instances, or at least one anyway, the lack of gun control. Most Americans would like much more rigorous gun control, but the power of the NRA, National Riflemen's Association, often thwarts that goal. And so, in a sense, you can understand why Trump initially had some appeal, because he presented himself as the anti-establishment politician, the politician who was going to drain the swamp. Of course, that was completely bogus, but the fact that he managed to persuade a lot of people shows the depth of disenchantment with the American political system. But you're quite right. There is considerable discontent. And the other thing is, and this is not confined to the United States, I think a major challenge for liberal democracies in the 21st century is the challenge of making the economy work better for more people. We have a global economy that for a relatively small number of people, it's marvelous. But for the rest, it's pretty grim. Lots of families in this country and others are doing two or three jobs a day and still are struggling. So it seems to me this is a major challenge, which is not going to go away. Because unlike previous eras, people who do not enjoy a wonderful standard of living have every possibility of seeing through the social media the lifestyle of people who do. And so their concerns and their grievances and their anger is not going to dissipate, and we need political leadership to try to solve some of those really huge problems about the economy and actually reducing the degree of inequality in the world and in nationally.
Unfortunately, that unrest is not limited to America.
No.
You see it in certain parts of Europe. You see it in Brexit and the fact that the government can't govern there, really.
Right. And, of course, implementing Brexit has turned out to be an unmitigated disaster for many of the people who voted for it. Not the people who led it, because they've all got very wealthy. Because they knew it would be a disaster, but they knew that they had a personal stake in it. I see that Nigel Farage, a key champion of Brexit, he hasn't been personally impoverished by it. In fact, quite the reverse.
Well, this is why I ask about the question about the Rust Belt, because I think that people are reacting against inequality that's been growing.
Yeah. But
and I think even in New Zealand, you have more cause to worry than you would have 20 years ago.
Yes, I agree. And, you know, the unfortunate thing is that many governments and many politicians have sold the lie that globalization has caused inequality. It has not. Globalization is a structural change, a bit like industrialization. It's the policy settings of governments that cause inequality. It's not, you know, Mr. Trump made out that rust belts were caused by American jobs being exported to other countries. Well, actually, that's a gross simplification. I mean, if you want to, if the world's becoming more interconnected through technology, there are examples of governments that have made conscious efforts to reduce inequality. Countries like Finland and Sweden, where taxation is higher 60%. And we may not want to go down that route, but it's not globalization. It's not the process of becoming more interconnected that's causing inequality. It's the policy settings of governments. And that's the crucial point to note.
But I think that in 30 years ago, that many people who were for a rules-based order and international economics kind of thought that neoliberalism would bring us there.
I don't think neoliberalism was ever intended to make everybody better off.
I know, but I think people had a misconception of what it would do.
Yes, they did, but that's deception. You know, let's be quite clear about this.
And part of this,
there are powerful narratives which justify the concentration of wealth and privilege in relatively few hands. And those narratives need to be challenged.
And one of the ways of politicians who don't want to change, well, they'll say it's immigration or it's refugees.
Or it's woke. I mean, woke is you know, this is a lovely phrase that's used by so many politicians. They use this term because they're too frightened to admit they want to uphold the status quo from which they benefit. So they call anyone who criticizes the status quo as woke, and they can't define the term because woke actually is derived from the word awakening.
Now, you think we're going to, I think that in some ways, dealing with climate change and dealing with political, both internationally and nationally, inequality, they need to go together to some extent because people have to feel that they're part of the solution, not part of the problem.
Yeah, I'm more optimistic in the future because I have the great privilege, as you know, Marvin, of teaching lots of young people. And we've seen this over Gaza, but we also see it over inequality. I think they have a less compartmentalized view of the world. And I think they've got the energy, the passion, and the ability to make progress where previous generations have failed. I mean, just because you and I are talking at a time when 800 billion people do not have enough to eat every day, it doesn't mean that we have to go on with that scenario forever. Just because we have 81 billionaires at the moment, as I speak to you, who have half the world's wealth, that doesn't mean we have to tolerate that forever. And as Willy Brandt, a great German politician, once remarked, problems created by human beings can be solved by them. So I'm of the view that education is very important to solve some of these problems, many of them. And I'm also got some confidence that young people will tackle problems like climate change and inequality with more energy than they're currently being done. So I do think that climate change and inequality are two massive problems and will probably haunt us for the best part of the 21st century. But I don't think we have to resign ourselves and say nothing can be done. I don't accept that.
Yeah, I suspect that many young people connect the two issues. And that's
many of them are very angry, as I find out firsthand. that these problems are not being tackled now because they're going to have to live with them. And, you know, in a way that you and I won't.
I'm a grumpy old man when it comes to that.
Well,
I
hope I'm not a grumpy old man yet, but I may well be in a few years' time. But
I feel like we should have been dealing with these much earlier.
And yes, of course.
And we haven't had the leadership that we should have from people in government.
I think a key thing is if we are going to make serious inroads into reducing international inequality, we need to start at home. And I think you know, a small liberal democracy like New Zealand could set an example to the world in trying to tackle the problem. At the moment, we haven't got the political will because the view we've got trickle-down economics at the moment. We've got the view that everybody can be empowered if they have tax cuts. And so we've got a bit of a back to the 70s, back to the 80s feel about things. But I remain hopeful that we will, as the world becomes a smaller place, make some serious inroads into tackling these problems.
Well, you talk to students at university, don't you?
Yeah.
And you listen, I suspect.
Yeah.
And when you mentioned Finland, I felt quite good about that because I know the resources that Finland has and doesn't have to a certain degree.
Right.
I mean, Norway, people say, point at Norway, that they got oil. And they do have oil. You can point to Sweden and say they were pretty heavily industrialized quite early, very soon. But what did Finland really have going for it? Trees and lakes. Not much in the way of, they didn't have oil, they didn't have great iron industrial resources, but yet they managed to make the welfare state work, including their education system. They managed to be willing to pay taxes and tax those.
Yeah, and they have a first-class infrastructure.
You know, if you get a fine for driving over the speed limit in Finland, you pay according to your income. The fine is.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's the answer, but it's an example where they are.
Yeah, and also countries like Denmark, you know, people are prepared to pay taxation at the level of 60%.
I think if you had the right kind of leadership and the right kind of information, why more and more people in New Zealand would be prepared to support that kind of.
Well, it depends. We've got to reach the point where, you know, something that came through to me during COVID-19 is how we depend on each other so much, particularly at a time of crisis. Nurses, bus drivers, taxi drivers, all those people, they don't hit the headlines, the road cleaners, people who clean buildings, but we all depend on each other. And unfortunately, we don't actually yet have an economic structure that reflects this level of interdependence. So I'm hoping that we do begin to move to a recognition that everyone is entitled to a reasonably decent life. And it's quite obscene. We have a situation at the moment, and it's not only immoral, but it's also irrational, where 81 billionaires have half the world's wealth. I mean, this is just, it's not sustainable. Why is it not sustainable? Because people who are deprived can see through their mobile I mean, take Somalia, one of the poorest countries in the world with the highest ownership of mobile telephones. Many Somalis can see how the rest of the world is living. And they know, unlike previous generations of poor people, that not everyone lives like them. So we're stoking up an explosive problem, particularly with rising levels of migration, because people will not tolerate this in the long run. And if we're serious about tackling problems like people smuggling and record levels of migration, then we need to actually try to improve the circumstances of the way people live so they don't have to take such desperate measures.
And you have to make your own people feel secure enough so they will back you.
Sorry, in what sense?
I mean, a country, I think inequality, even if a relatively wealthy country, inequality actually makes for uncertainty.
It does.
And mistrust of the society.
Insecurity, uncertainty. It also breeds extremism.
Yeah.
Because it breeds
distrust.
Yes, one of the reasons that Mr. Trump has quite considerable traction, because there's a lot of angry Americans. There's a lot of people who feel they haven't been given a fair shake. They haven't been given a fair chance despite working very hard. And a politician comes along and promises everything. And they think, well, maybe he's not being truthful, but at least he's promising us something, whereas we just seem to have previously been bypassed by the system. So, yeah, I mean, if we are serious about, so in short, not tackling problems like inequality and climate change could ultimately endanger democracy.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on board, Robert.
Very
actually
welcome,
you made me feel more positive than when I began this interview. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.